famous song.
This chapter of the Hamlet is extolling the virtues of the righteous individual who will merit to dwell in the sanctuary of God in the world to come. But even in this world, the person who is suited to ascend to the house of the Lord, any interprets and attains each of the virtues mentioned to their furthest point, to the extreme. The Talmud quotes passages from biblical attributes of individuals mentioned in the Torah, anecdotes in description of each of these phrases.
Well, the phrases are quoted very often, which we'll recognize. The Talmud goes to great detail in describing each and every phrase that David HaMelech mentions here. And they say that these are ideas that are l'fnim ashur sadin, that people are supposed to go beyond the letter of the law. Now, we could question why this is considered going beyond the letter of the law, but as we'll see, the different requirements, the different ideas that are mentioned, we'll be able to appreciate it more. Now, it deals with Ben Adam L'Chaver, which is important. Of course, man's relationship with his fellow's man, with his fellow man. And the famous quote here to bring down the introduction from the Yerushalmi, which says that the people of David's generation were righteous and observant people, yet they, many times they would fall in battle. And we know that if the people supposedly were righteous and observant, they're not supposed to fall in battle. That's one of the great benefits, great blessings that are written in the Torah, that if a person is righteous and observant, so he would not be harmed in battle. Yet the people in David's generation succumbed in battle. On the other hand, in Achav, who was the evil Achav, the idolater, so they many times emerged victorious in battle without any casualties, as the Torah mentioned, the greatness. Now, how could that be? These were people that were Rishoyim, people that were evil, that worshipped idolatry, and yet they were unharmed in battle. As I said, because they didn't have slanderers and talebearers. That means because in order to have David, the people were very concerned with everybody else's honor and everybody else's kavod. And we know that also from the famous story of Akiva, that the 24,000 students died, great scholars. So it says, Shemanoah, the Kovit Zeb is there because they didn't have the proper respect and recognition, each person for their fellow man. The fact that they were lacking Beinodah Mechadero, so therefore the plague visited them and 24,000 succumbed. The same is true in David's generation. Now, some make note that why was David's generation so corrupt? One would think that even if they're not directly related, but a generation that was very strong in Benodom Lamoko, between man and God, would also be strong in Benodom Lamoko. It's surely not a harmful influence if the generation of Achav that was so far away from Benodom Lamoko was close to Benodom Lamoko. So one would think that serving God Benodom Lamoko would surely foster and engender more of a proper relationship between Benodom Lechavero. Yet in David's time, it was to the contrary. So some of the commentators point out that the problem was with the leaders. During David's period, there were two great people we spoke of in the past Psalms, Doeg, or Edomi, and Achitophel, who were very wise, intelligent, respected, honored people. They were enemies of David. And David described how corrupt and depraved they were in their inner spirit. And the fact that they were the leaders, and they engaged in such slander and bloodshed, so that had a very negative influence and impact upon the rest of the people. So although the people will say, hell to Beinodom Lamoko, they were dedicated to Beinodom Lamoko, but just like by us, it's not so like you have to, we don't even begin to think, we don't even talk about Beinodom Lechavero. And the Doeg and Achitophel had a very bad effect upon the people of David's generation. Now, Hirsch points out that the first paragraph, the first phrase is, Mi yogur be'olecha, who will be able to reside in the tent of God? And so obviously it implies the idea of residing in God's tent. So it implies the topic of serving Hashem, of God's service, right? Yet it immediately goes into the relationship Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. So it proves that if a person wants to come to Hashem, he can't do so until he first was made himself acceptable Ben Adam L'Chaveiro to his fellow man. And we know that's what the halacha is, that a person cannot find forgiveness through God unless he first makes restitution or finds forgiveness with his fellow man. Only then can he go ahead and can he approach God. This is a very important concept. But really there's another way of looking at it. So one will say, but it's still Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, it's not between God and man, it's only between man and man, and why is it so significant and so important? The other week I had this thought that really, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and man, means how I act towards this fellow man, towards the needy, towards the sick. Is it really a relationship between mortal and mortal, or is there another aspect of that relationship? Looking at it, it's also a relationship between God and man in a certain way. Because when the Torah describes the actions of God, as we've quoted many times, it says, this awesome, fierce God, what does he do? He gives the needy, he gives the widow, he gives the orphan, he gives those that are deprived. Giving to the needy, the widow, the orphan, encouragement, help, support, that's something that we would call Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and man. But it's really not Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, it's between man and God, because this is what God is doing. So basically, my relationship between myself and my fellow man is in a way also called Ben Adam L'Mokom, between man and God. You could call it Ben Mokom L'Adam, between God and man, because God is using me as a vehicle, as an instrument of fulfilling his mission, which is the help and the salvation of those who need it. So in a sense, when I participate in that, I am doing the service of God. So if you look at it in that way, so you don't have a Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, something that deals only with mortals, and it's completely divorced from God. You have a Ben Adam L'Mokom, meaning how I serve God, and you could use the term Ben Mokom L'Adam, how God serves man. And I, when I'm Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, in that way, I am used the conduit, the vehicle, a method of God fulfilling his service to man of Ben Mokom L'Adam. When you look at it that way, you see a certain divine service also in the interrelationship between one man and the second. That's the different approach, because really, in that way, Mi yogur be'olecha, when we say in the first passage that Hirsch says, who will be able to dwell, but to sojourn in your tent? Meaning, who can sojourn in God's tent? And it's really proper for him then to go and say, if he emphasizes the point of yogur be'olecha, like Hirsch says, to give it a little more emphasis, he goes into God's tent. By going into God's tent, in that way, he is able to be yishkon by being there. If he deals kindly with his fellow man, he's therefore fulfilling the greatness of God. Now, what do we speak about here? Well, some say the olech on your tent refers to the heavens. According to the Radak, he says that the ohalecha refers to who will be able to be in God. What is God's tent? The heavens that are stretched out. Mi yishkon behar kodesheicha. And this refers to the Beis HaMikdash, which is on the Holy Mountain. Because the Beis HaMikdash is the location of the most sacred place on earth. When you think into that, and you look at the place of the Beis HaMikdash, we just become accustomed to look at it. But if there is a place which is sacred on this earth, everything is sacred, but the concentration of the Shekhinah, if you look at it, you can see it in the Mokim of the Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, when a tzaddik sees that Mokim, it makes an impression. Ein zekim, what did Yaakov Avinu say? Ein zekim, beis elikim, v'zeh shaar shamayim. When he came to the Mokim HaMikdash, when he saw, he said, this is God's home, and this is the gateway to heaven. So he's saying, Mi yogur, who is the one who will dwell there, who will inherit there? Now, some emphasize the word yogur and yishkon. The Malbim says that yogur means permanent residence,
and Yishkon means temporary residence. Hirsch gives the contrary interpretation, but according to the Malbin, it would fit in very well, because Mi Yorgu Be'olecha, meaning who would be a permanent resident. It's speaking about the heavens, it's speaking about the Olam HaNesham, it's a spiritual world where a person is there for eternity. And Mi Yishkon, Yishkon according to him is a temporary dwelling. Temporary dwelling would be on this earth. So Mi Yishkon Behar Kodeshecha, who can really aspire to dwell Behar Kodeshecha in the place anybody could dwell there? We would think that anybody could dwell there. What does it mean, Mi Yishkon? Who is suited to dwell there? Normally you would say, who is suited? You can't stop him. I mean, if somebody is a culprit, so he's going to go there, what are you going to do, throw him out? I mean, how do you know the inner spirit of the person to throw him out? So you would have to interpret, Mi Yishkon Behar Kodeshecha, who is suited to dwell Behar Kodeshecha. But you can say a little further, I mean, which person really appreciates? I mean, all of us could really go, we don't feel compelled, we don't feel drawn, we'll say, to be in the Makom HaMikdash. If we'd have the Makom HaMikdash, and if it would be free, and if it would be Tahar, how many of us would walk by it and really be inspired with a fearful, awesome feeling and say that this is like Yaakov Avinu, Enver King, Basil King? I would venture to say not everyone, because if it would have been that way, then the Chassidus would have never been destroyed. So the idea is really, Mi Yishkon Behar Kodeshecha, it means who really would appreciate it to be a Shochem Behar Kodeshecha. The fact is that a person may go through the outward trading, the outward acts or machinations, we'll say, his actions of a very religious person. But does he have the true spirit that he should really, we'll say, long to be in the environment in Hashem's relationship? So really not. He would have to be a person who is a Helech Tomim, who is pure of spirit. A person who is pure of spirit, he will want and aspire to be Shochem Behar Kodesh. Another person wouldn't. And I'll tell you a very simple reason why not, because he would have a guilt complex. We'll say, even if a person will say, Kurtzansville, and then he eats Kodesh, and he does all the mitzvahs outwardly, and he does all the mitzvahs, they don't have the market to the greatest extreme. But if he totally ignores Beinodim Lechaveiro, there's a total, there's a guilt complex, annoying feeling within him. And therefore, you can't say that he would be aspiring to be Behar Kodesh, because on one hand, he would want to be there, and the other hand, he would be ashamed, you know, because in his mind, he would have all the feelings of what he's left. So therefore, for a person to truly aspire to be Yishkon Behar Kodesh, you have to have the purity of soul. And this is what he mentions a little further. Holich Tomim, a person who walks in perfect innocence. Now the Gemara and Makos, and there are many Midrashim, which explain and bring down the different phrases here. And they say that they refer to various people. Now Holich Tomim, they say refers to Avram Avinu. By Avram Avinu it says, Yisalech Lefonai Ve'yei Tomim, that go before me, and Ve'yei Tomim, and you will be perfect. That means Tom is the first perfect in innocence. The person who is perfect in innocence, that person is called Tomim. So the idea is that a person who is always Tomim, who is innocent with Hashem, meaning he has no other thoughts, he totally believes and is enamored with the idea that he's serving God, and we find the expression in the Torah, Tomim Kiyim Hashem Alekecha, Haltach Ker Achar Asitos, the Talmud says, that a person should be perfectly innocent with Hashem and not look into the future. Haltach Ker Achar Asitos, have faith in God. Don't try to determine through the various oracles and the various types of magic that they used to use what is going to happen, but have faith in God. Now this, of course, doesn't necessarily refer only to magic. I mean, the person, now we don't have this power of magic. So we have other forces within us that try to provide totally for the future. And we neglect to realize that the only true future there is determined by Hashem. So all of us have to have this idea of tmimus, that we realize that we are totally, coming completely, totally involved and trust in God. That's the first requirement. Ukoel tzedek, and a person does good deeds. That means, according to the Radak, he says, that the idea of doing, there are three different ways that a person serves God or lives. First with thoughts, with words, and with actions. So first, David HaMelech mentions the praise of the person who is scrupulous in acting with the deeds. That, of course, that's the first requirement, that he should act in a scrupulous way. So poel tzedek, poel is a noun. Now, according to the Talmud, the Gemara, however, poel is a verb. The Gemara, however, uses it as a noun, as a description. Poel tzedek, an honest worker. Now, what's so important about an honest worker? What is an honest worker? You wonder sometimes if he lives up to the union laws, the union labor, that's an honest worker. When they were building this shul, I remember coming here 9 o'clock in the morning one time, and everybody was sitting around. We were rushing, maybe it'll be ready for yonder. They had their first coffee break of the day. We see what an honest worker could really do. If you don't have an honest worker, a whole country could fall apart. But to what degree do you call an honest worker? So the Talmud gives us a story of Abba Chilki. It says once the people needed rain, so they sent two rabbis, two great people, to him that Abba Chilki should pray for rain. So when they came, they found him, this great tzaddik, hoeing the field. He was working in the field. So they greeted him, but he didn't even turn around to them. So after the day was finished, he explained to the people that the reason why he didn't answer them, because he was a day laborer and would be cheating his employer if he so much as greeted them at a time when he was being paid to work. So he calls this a poel tzedek, an honored worker. There are very few people who really feel this, the idea that to be an honest worker, what does it mean? What does it mean? It's interesting. This Shabbos, I was out of town. I walked into these people from Mincha. So before Mincha, they were saying Yeshir, they were running Gemara. So somebody was saying Yeshir, he found Tochen, and he was giving them a halachic difference from a kavlan, from a person who is an honest worker, a skiryon, a day worker, or a kavlan is one who takes the job, to do the job. The skiryon doesn't finish a contract. The skiryon doesn't care. At the end of the day, if the pipe working, the pipe isn't working, he put in 8-9 hours, and he wants his money. He doesn't care if it's working or not. So in this way, it's putting down a little mosquito. So there was one person sitting there who took great offense because he's a person who works. And he says, what do you mean? He says, if they ask me to fix the pipe, and if I'm 5 o'clock and the pipe isn't working, I'm not going to quit and say my job is done and take my money. He says, I feel an obligation, I feel a responsibility to go ahead and to fix what they want. I mean, that's what's called an honest work. So I was looking at a rate of moderation. This person was sitting. Obviously, he was a scholar. He never fixed the pipe, and he never, theoretically, that's what a skiryon is. The other person is also a finder, a big Talmud Chacham and everything, but he makes a living with this kind of manual work. So by him, his concept of a skiryon was not just to work up the hours and get paid. That's not a true description, because according to him, this would be a lack of honesty. But most of us do have this concept of skiryon. They don't realize that a worker has to really accomplish something. And, the whole concept is foreign to that. I had an incident where a plumber came to fix the heat. So he was going to fix the heat. He spent 2 hours there. And then he sends me the bill, $45. He doesn't know what's the matter with it. So I said to him, well, why should I pay you $45? If you can before you tell me what's the matter with it, then you deserve your $45. And no, it was a half hour. So I don't know what's the matter with it. So my time isn't worth $45 a half hour to play around with it. I'm not Bama Lovey, you're getting $5. But if you're charging me $45 for a half hour, you have to tell me there is something wrong, there isn't something wrong, not to spend I'm paying you as an expert. So the whole idea of this here y'all is gone to an extreme that without any feeling of responsibility, yet when you look into here y'all here, this was the case of Rabbi Chilki. In fact, the benching, a person who's a skiryon doesn't have to bench the whole benching, not to take away the extra few minutes. He's makatsir the benching. The Mishnahs and Brachas tell us how much a dekrishme has to say. Does he have to go down? And the rabbanon, he doesn't do, right? All kind of laws when you're dealing with a fraction of a second. The idea is not a fraction of a second. It's much more. That's the whole fabric of society. The Rabbi HaMelech says, if a person is a poel tzedek, this is important to the degree of holich tamim. Holich tamim may be between God and man, too. Poel tzedek means that this is doing the work that God gave man in a proper way. V'dober emes bilvaveh. Now here again, dober emes bilvaveh. What is the idea of dober emes bilvaveh? To what extreme does that go? That means, what extreme does that go? He says that a man is very careful, right? That even if he never made an oral commitment, he made a mental decision, so that's considered to be that what? That he must fulfill his decision. Now this, of course, is within Yeshua Sabin. Because we know in the halakha, if I say I'm going to sell something to you, so then legally, I really don't even have to pay you with that until you do a kinyan, a method of transaction. But there, the Gemara says you should be aimed b'dibure, right? Only b'dibure, you should go ahead and fulfill that which you said. But the l'tnei m'shur sadin goes so far that not even that which you say you should fulfill, but you should fulfill that which you think in your mind. And the Gemara gives you the famous case that Rav Safed put up an article for sale. When he was reciting the Shema, a person came to him and said, I'll give you this and this amount for the article. So he wasn't able to reply because he was in the middle of Kriya Shema. But the buyer thought that he wouldn't even answer him because it's a preposterous proposition, so it's such a little sum of money. So he went right away to a higher bid. When Rav Safed completed the Shema, so he told the man, here's the article, and take it for the price that you first mentioned. Because at the time you made the original offer, I heard you, and I accepted a mental decision, although I wasn't able to speak back. So therefore it was already sold as yours. And if it was sold of yours, I can't change my mind anymore. So this is how far the Devar enters the Lord. That's why I said in the introduction, it's l'tnin m'shurasad, and we find in the halacha many cases of that. That shows us in truth how important the idea of poel tzedek is. That if Hashem was mevater on his kavod for that, so also the kavod of the bnei adam, because it would be, in a sense, incongruous to say that for God's kavod is not necessary. But for the kavod of a person, there's another example. With the same Rav Safed, it's also in a different Talmudic passage, which tells us the story a little different. It says the following, and this troubled me yesterday. It says, Maisohoyda was a story of Rav Safed, and went one city outside. One day he went out of the city, Latayalim Talmido, to go ahead and to take a walk with his disciples. So the same Rav Safed. So Koga Bechosid Echot, so he saw a Chosid, meaning a very pious person who was traveling on the other side of the road, coming against him. So he said to Rav Safed, why did you have to come out to greet me with all your disciples? I mean, I'm not worthy of such a thing. Because he thought Rav Safed was coming out to greet him, but he was only taking a walk. I told him, my intent was not to greet you. I only went out to take a walk. So the Chassid became ashamed. So the students asked Rav Safed, like we would ask the question, why did you tell him that? What do you care if he feels good? If he thinks that you came to greet him, why do you care if he feels good? Rav Kapha said, why should I lie? So they said to him, you should have remained silent. So he said to him, but if I would have remained silent, then I wouldn't fulfill the dover and the zilvavo, Shavit HaMelech said. That means true honesty has to be total, even zilvavo. We understand, this shows us how deep it goes, because we would answer the question is, but the poor fellow, he's a bear. So we understand, obviously we're not in that madrega, but if Rav Safed says, they said to Rav Safed, why'd you tell him? So he said, so why should I lie? That they understood. That means if Rav Safed would have to lie and articulate that I'm coming to greet you, we may not understand it, but his students understood that he shouldn't have done that. What they couldn't understand is, why can't you remain silent? But Rav Safed's understanding of Sheker was that it has to be not only articulating, like we've been speaking, even the machshov and the thought has to be as pure and as honest as the articulation. So he says, if the person, by my remaining silent, will think that I came, so in a sense it's also considered what Sheker. This is because Rav Safed has such a far-reaching understanding of the concept of Sheker, the students were like one removed from that. We are like even removed from the students. We would think, honestly, it troubled me for a long time, you know, that maybe it's worth, for, you know, to go ahead and to tell the person, it may be worth, since we're speaking about it, maybe it's worth to tell the person that, you know, that you really mean, that you really mean, how are you supposed to sing and dance and say in the presence of a bride at a wedding? So Beis Shammai says, Kala Kemeis Shehi. that to say, oh, the Kala has a nice complexion and she has nice eyes, and you say to make she he if she is, like, and if she doesn't have it, you just say the good feature. So Tosa speaks up, and if she has something wrong, you stick or remain quiet. The lawyer's not cool, and don't go and praise her. Or praise her like she has nice eyes, or nice feet, or nice hands, or whatever people will say. But they still disagrees, and they still says, no. Kala and Noe Vitasudo. You always have to say that the Kali is nice and gracious, like a Hucho. So Beishamai said to Beis Hillel, but what happens if she was a cripple or a blind? And you say, Kali Noah Hasuda, the Torah says, Mitvah Sheker, Tirchot, you're not supposed to say a lie. So Beis Hillel turns around and just says to Beishamai, he did Rechem, according to you, if a person went ahead and he thought he got a good thing in a sale, Misha Lokach Mekach Kamin Hashu, but it came out he was really fooled, and he made a bad deal. So what are you going to go and do? Add salt to his injury? Yishabchenu ve'enu. So Beis Hillel says, what do you say? You should, to Beis Shammai, should you praise it? Or you ganenu ve'enu. Or you should say, oh boy, did you get fooled? You got really, pleased. So he says, ha've'emir, it goes without saying. Yishabchenu ve'enu. Don't make him feel bad, but praise it. And from here the Chachamim said, le'elon tehei daite shalodon mi'olevi esima brios. The idea is that you should try to please people. So basically, Rav Safka, if we have to say, was more Beis Shammai. The idea is, what did Beis Hillel say? Beis Hillel felt that you have to weigh both of these concepts, and therefore, it's no mitzvah to blurt out. It's like this. So really, the Gemara gives you two examples of how far these mitzvahs go. What we see from the case of the Talmud is the absolute, as far as a human being can pursue it. The idea of Toil tzedek of an honest day's work will stay as far as you can pursue it. The ultimate, to such an extreme, the idea, but again, maybe Beis Hillel would argue with that, the same way he argued with Beis Shammai on the idea of Dover and Mizvilvon. See that when you take absolute truth or absolute honesty and so on, somebody will be hurt innocently. On the other hand, sometimes you'd say you have to make a sacrifice for absolute truth and absolute honesty. How far do you go? Even Beis Hillel would be made it, you know, that there's a certain degree. But Rav Safka went to that again. When he emphasizes the absolute requirement, he gives you perhaps, not necessarily that they're telling you that you should emulate that, but he's trying to tell you to what degree that Toil Tzedek and Dever Emes Dovame, how far does that? Lo Rogal Ala Shene. He doesn't have slander. The word of Rogal means what? Slander. The reason it's called Rogal is because a person goes, comes from regel, goes from door to door, tale-mongering. That's where they say lechlochil ba'anecho. In the Torah it's written, they say lechlochil. Lochil is a peddler. We go around peddling cosmetics, and so we find the idea of lochil. So a person shouldn't, a person in a lochil shouldn't walk around. Now David HaMelech, when he uses it, doesn't use the word rogil, a peddler, but rogal, which is also the idea of a regel, walking around and talking Lashon Hara. So David HaMelech says here he's going into the negative. He speaks graciously of accomplishments, also in avoiding the negative commands. He never says anything that's slanderous. And they say that L'Rogel Al-Shane goes so far, which of the Avos do they compare L'Rogel Al-Shene? They compare this to Yaakov Avinu. Why? Well, it says because Yaakov Avinu, when he was told by his mother to go ahead and to impersonate his brother Esau, so he refused because he said, perhaps my father will feel me and Yimasheni Avi, and I'll seem to him to be like a deceiver. So the idea was, what does that have to do with L'Rogel Al-Shene? Because the truth was even dearer to Yaakov Avinu. The idea it emphasizes the truth, because he wasn't able to go ahead and to do that until the mother said, alike in the lost spot. Whatever the reason was, the mother, the Rashi said, that why did he agree? Because the mother told him that she received the Nebuah, a prophetic vision or a message that he should go ahead and get the prophet. But other than that, he would refuse to do that because of honesty. So L'Rogel Al-Shene, meaning that the person was speaking, this implies that the Rogel is truth. Actually, you could have slander even with truth. because refuse could be, it's true, but if there's no reason for you to go ahead and to tell someone else, that's called refuse. But the Gemara means here that idea of honesty, it took a case of slander, a case of dishonesty, and it wanted to show you, you know, when it was, when it, I mean, it had nothing to do with truth, but it wanted to show you the concept of dishonesty, that until the mother told, it wasn't outward dishonest, until the mother told him that there was a prophetic message, so he refused to do it. Now it says, Le'rogel al l'sheinai, on his tongue, Le'osu l're'eyu ro. It says he didn't do evil l're'eyu to his friend. And the cherpo le'noso al kreven. Now what is the cherpo le'noso al kreven? Meaning disgrace, he did not bring about or carry over al kreven on that which, on the one that was close. Now, the first part, it uses two expressions, l're'eyu, meaning a friend, and kreven, meaning a close kinsman. So on the first pasuk of le'osu l're'eyu ro, it says this refers to a man who, the Gemara says, who never competes unfairly with his business rivals and never illegally encroaches on their rights. Now this is something which is almost missing totally from commerce, we'll say, or from commerce in relationships today in business, because in business everything goes. So here the idea is, no, he never competes unfairly with his business rival, and he doesn't encroach on their rights. Nor he doesn't disgrace on that one which is intimate to him. Now, the Radak points out that krovo, the second part of the sentence, refers to a closer relation than the first part, which is re'eyu. So it seems that he's saying, not only doesn't he treat his re'eyu, his neighbor, his friend, in an improper manner, but al krovo, the one that's real close to him, he also treats him in a proper manner. He doesn't bring about disgrace. So the Radak says that even if his friends, although he won't say this, we observe how careful this man is, that even if his friends and intimates curse and insult him, he will not retaliate with harsh words. Meaning generally people go ahead and they feel free to insult someone who is very dear to them. If the person is a stranger, a neighbor, so in a sense he's inhibited, he doesn't know how the other person will take out his anger in him, and there are certain social ways. But when he's dealing with Krovo, with his neighbor, with his family friend, there he doesn't feel any restraint or restriction. So if he feels in some way that he was harmed, so he'll just pour out all kind of invective against him. It doesn't mean that he becomes, according to the Radak, more angry, but it means that he doesn't have any curbs or restraints which will inhibit his response. To a stranger, they could do the same act. And maybe the stranger is even more angry. This is a fortaina. But at the stranger, his response can't be that strong. Whereas to a family member, his response can be. That's one way the Radak says. Rashi says a little different. Rashi says that the idea is if you see a very close person doing a sin, you won't overlook it. And that's true. When you see someone else, say, you're an enemy, you have your enemies with someone. And a friend of yours, who's an associate of yours, is consorting with that person who is your enemy. So you feel real bad. Why? Because he's your friend. Why doesn't he feel, you know, the anguish you feel from the other person? How dare he consort with that person? But you remain silent. Why? Because you say, look, he's still a friend, he's a human being, he's his own man, he can do whatever he wants. But if your flesh and blood, or your child, or your kinsman does it, not a kinsman, but your relation does it, so you can't understand it, you literally come up with a greater hatred. Why? Because he is your brother, he's your flesh and blood, and he doesn't realize the anguish and the suffering, and he's consorting with someone who is such an enemy of yours. So your reaction and your response is what? Is even greater sometimes. Hatred can even be stronger, when it, and that's truly emotional. In fact, this is one of the answers that they give. The question we find in the Torah, that a person is not allowed to bear witness against their close kinsman. Correct? So you'll say, obviously, because he'll always be beneficial to his brother, to his father, he'll always say something good. So he'll say, fine, so that we can understand, and we won't accept any evidence, right, that he will say, which is beneficial for his relative. But if he's not beneficial, if his evidence is to the contrary, if it's accusatory, and if he's bringing evidence against his kinsman, you should surely believe it because it's still his relative, and he's still bringing evidence against him. So why don't you believe him? So Well, some of the commentaries say the reason is because if a person becomes angry at a relative, the hatred and the venom sometimes and the anger is much more severe than if it would be against another person. Therefore, you surely can't believe him when it's lefeva. In a sense, that's what Rashi is telling here, that not only le'os l'rei ro, but the careful le'os l'freida. That's interesting, even the term careful. You know, the careful le'os l'freida. Normally you would say to the Korah, it's like a disgrace for you to go ahead. You're using the idea of a chirpa because you can't appreciate how he being so close to you. There's one more thought that they want to say. The chirpa le'os l'freida, it says that he goes out of his way to establish, not only he doesn't go to punish them, but he goes out of his way to establish closer relationships with them, the karavis chirpa. That he goes out of his way for a person who is closer to establish closer. Now you would think that you have to treat everybody equal. You would think that you shouldn't hold favors. Is there such an idea? Because we're speaking here with human responses. Would you say that I should treat everybody equal, relative or a friend? There is no difference between relative or friend. Or the fact that someone is a relative demands a closer kinship and a closer relation. From that one who is the sofa close to you, Alti Salein, you should not hold back fraternally. We find in the degrees of charity, it says who do you give first. So if your family needs charity, you also have to give to your family. Find the idea of someone's divorced wife needs help. So there is an idea of him giving charity also because of Mitzvot Alti Salein, although there's no relationship right now. So this idea of the careful and not self-craving, he once says he goes to the country and the car is craved off. Not only he doesn't speak against them, but in a sense he brings a closer feeling to them, a fraternal feeling. So this is truly in consonance with what the Torah really demands, and not absolute that there is no difference. There are certain things which are within the framework, and certain things which are, and that you really can't demand from the individual. Now, Nivzeh be'enov nimos, in his eyes, the despicable person is repulsive, meaning he... person who is nivza, who is an ingrate, the person who is morally lacking. So you look at him. It's not just, but nimos, it's ugly, it's abominable. In its literal sense, many times we look at a person who is a nivza and it doesn't bother us. So we know he's an ingrate, we know he's a great person, we know he's morally bankrupt, and there's no ethics. But do you say that it causes you to turn away, that you can't look at him? We know that we look at him. And we know that he's no good. But it doesn't make us grow up. It doesn't make us turn away and run away. If we go by the street and there's a carcass there that has a terrible odor, right? No matter how big a tzaddik we are, it's a terrible odor. So we'll close the windows of the car, and we'll drive by, or we'll run away, and it's impossible. But if we see a person who physically, outwardly, there is no smell, there's no taint, you know? But the person is so corrupt and so despicable that morally the odor is beyond being, but we don't even smell it. We don't even smell it because we're not attuned in moral sense to see the weakness and the cheapness of this. But here's a person who is nivzeh, a person who is really bozzy. He admits that the person is a lowlife, but it's so far at nimos that in his mind, or to him, it's actually repulsive. So it means that not only the physical brings out a repulsive sense, a feeling of repulsion, but also the spiritual aspect determines this. Now the Gemara gives you a perfect example how far it could go. It can go as far. The Gemara gives you an example with Chizkiyahu, right? That the Gemara marks that he took his father off of us, who was an idolater, and he took his father. And he not only gave him no final rights, he didn't say, Shiva will say, but when his father died, he dragged his father's bones on a bed of rope to display how despicable the wicked were in his eyes, even if it was his own father. So here again, you have the extreme. The father, the fact was, Ahaz, if you think into Ahaz, who he was, how despicable this Ahaz was, because of Ahaz were idolaters. I mean, we don't appreciate the idea of idolatry, but let's take a look if this Assad in Syria, we call it. If this, he died, and say he had a son who was a mensch, not a behemoth.
your son was a mensch, and this son would say, my father released Lieutenant Goodman to Jesse, but he went ahead and he bombed out a whole city and killed 50,000 in Hamar, whatever it was, bloodless, ruthless. He taught little children to break the necks and eat the snakes. So this father is despicable. Would we condemn him if he took Afar Assad, took his father, and he dragged his bones like a dog? Would we condemn him? Would we? No. King Akkad, who was an idolater and perhaps misled hundreds of thousands of people, we'll say, and that they perish in Gehenna because of his idolatry, he not only murdered them from this world, we'll say, but he murdered them eternally. So isn't he a despicable person? It may not smell as much as the carcass. Yeah, he uses good perfume. But the idea is, spiritually, it's corrupt and decadent. It's not any different than the physical aspect. So if you can appreciate the physical aspect, but if you deal even on the, if you want to question, we'll say that there is no way in the world that a son should drag the father's bones. No way in the world. Instance in the world where a father, under the worst circumstances, we'll say Hitler's slur. Hitler killed about 6 million people. Because of his father. I mean, were you ready to make such a statement? Or you could say that Hitler is so repulsive and so repugnant, it's understandable that the son would drag him. I'm ready to say that. If you are ready to say that. But if you are ready to say that, and if you think into it, you'll have to come up in your own mind. If the father went ahead for 7 years, would run into the nursery and every morning, and take every little child and squeeze his neck and then break his head and drink the and when he dies, his son should do after 120 years after doing this to 6 million little children, the son should cry and give his people, 100 people. Each person will have a certain threshold of guilt, but almost every one of the 100 will agree and will be able to scenario where you get the most horror stories where you can appreciate that the son would react to that. Now, I gave you a great horror scenario. I thought that would turn everybody, but maybe it didn't. Can't you picture any one instance and circumstance where the son should not do this to a father? Can't you think?
Before, we discussed it last time. That a person who is bossy, Bossy meaning who is a cheapened individual, who's morally, we'll say, deficient, spiritually deficient. The Enoch, in the eyes of the righteous person, Nemos, he is abominable, he is repulsive. Normally, we don't react that way. If we see a person and there's a foul odor from a person, or there's a physical physical neglect, the way he goes dressed, the way he conducts himself. So most, we say he's repulsive. Yet if the person, we'll say, is all outwardly, he's perfect. He goes dressed meticulously. The fact, we'll say, that he is morally decrepit, debilitated. So in a sense, it doesn't bring out the same reaction to us, from us. The David HaMelech says, this righteous individual sees beneath the veneer. And Nitzah, a person who we may only consider as being despicable, his deeds are despicable, but that doesn't make the individual repulsive to us. But he looks at this individual and he sees the essence of his character. And although the veneer may be shiny, but if in essence the person is despicable, then the whole person becomes repulsive in his eyes. Now, this shows that this person is not influenced by the overt or the outward appearance, but he's able to insert it, but what concerns him is the essence of the individual himself. Now, the Talmud uses this to the extreme, and this is what we discussed last time, that King Ahaz, was an idolater. And when he died, the son of Hizkiyahu, who succeeded him, and who was a righteous king, and one of the few righteous kings of that period, so he gave his father no honor, but he dragged his father's bones on a bed of ropes to display how despicable the wicked were in his eyes, even if it be his own father. Now, it's difficult for us to comprehend at first glance, but when, because we're speaking about King Ahaz the king, what could have been so terrible? But we said King Ahaz will say, murder millions of people, or tens of millions of people, spiritually brought about their downfall. So then we can already begin to see how disgraceful it is. Much as you would take a Hitler, or Yamash Shema, or someone like that, and you would say that he had a son who after this right, and the son after the father, the hangman who killed millions of people, of children, so the son wouldn't give him any respect, but he dragged his bones in the street. So that we would appreciate. We would be able to comprehend and understand that. So what if Hitler is his father? But here's a person who killed and murdered millions of people, so that we can appreciate the fact that he dragged him to the street. Yet we ourselves here do not appreciate the fact that you had an Ahaz who spiritually destroyed millions of souls. So it's not any different than physically destroying bodies. And Ezekiel, therefore, gave him no respect and dragged him. So in a sense, I'm bringing this as an example. Why do we even question the connection? Because we also don't have this perspective of Nisr Be'enov Nimas. That means Hitler, Moses, he was a murderer, physically he annihilated. Yeah, we can understand that. But Ahaz spiritually annihilated. Why don't we understand that the spiritual annihilation is at least equal, if not much greater, than a physical annihilation? So because we also are lacking the comparison to a degree of Nivzeh Be'enov Nimas. So that makes the example of Hizkiyahu that much greater and that more emphatic, to say that by him, the Nivzeh and the Nimas, if we're using the lesson of the outwardly, the physical appearance and the spiritual value, were equally the same. That's one interpretation. Now others interpret it in a more personal sense, that this person is extremely humble, and in his own eyes, he always considers himself to be despicable and repulsive. He's very humble. Now, why is a person despicable and repulsive? I mean, he's a liar, a person's not despicable and repulsive. But there are many things, really, that the person, if he wants to pick on his own being and pick on himself, he can say he's despicable and repulsive. I mean, many thoughts may go through his mind. They're fleeting thoughts that go through his mind, but if he'll stop for a moment to think them, they may find him to be despicable and repulsive. But the idea is, what we do is we overlook a lot of those thoughts, and we only stop in the good thoughts. But a person who is humble, he evaluates himself properly, and therefore he picks out these shortcomings. So Nivzeh Be'enov, not only is he Nivzeh, but Nimos. He looks at himself, like we say in the Tfilas Vidui, you know, Yom Kippur, Mo Ani, Mo Chayai, what am I, what is my life, Ofor Rimo Besoleh, I mean, when we speak, I'm just dust and ashes, and Rimo, and I'll become worm, Leo. So in a sense, the person looks at his weaknesses, and he therefore considers himself to be lacking to such a degree that he's not satisfied with himself, and he tries to perfect himself, but he's a humble individual. But Yirei Hashem Yechaveh, when he sees others who revere God, he honors. So on the same line of thinking, it's good to be humble. But like the Rishon Zalantra says, I mean, when can you tell a person's humble? He just has a rotten, cynical nature. I mean, it could be that nobody does anything, but there is nothing that's good. Everything is terrible. You know, everything is terrible because there's nothing good. So therefore, you can't say he's a humble person. A humble person means that he recognizes his own fault, but when he sees something good in others, he acknowledges their, you know, their greatness or their purity or their character traits, and he acknowledges and respects it. That shows the reason why he considers himself to be inferior is because of his humility. But if, on the other hand, he degrades others and he detracts from their character, so he's just a cynical person, but he's not really a humble person. So therefore he says, Nivzeh Be'enov Nimas, but the Yirei Hashem Yechaveh, at the same time when he sees another person who is a Yirei Hashem, who shows respect of God, reverence to Yechaveh, he acknowledges this and he gives him respect because he realizes that that person has great character. Now, the Talmud, who compares the first half of the phrase, Yehoshaphat, when he would have to see a Torah scholar, although he was the king, he would rise out of his throne joyously and cry out, "My father, my master, my teacher," because he's taken the great respect that he showed for a person who has Yirah Shamayim and for a person who is great in Torah. Although he was the king, can you envision this? Humbling himself in his presence, yet he humbled himself in his presence. So it shows you two cases, according to the Talmud, of kings of Judea, kings who were able to overlook the outward kingly, the outward royal, we'll say, draperies of royal honor and glory, and look at the essence of the individual himself. If the Yehoshaphat or if the Chizkiyahu would go ahead after Nachas dies, and he would give him the glory of a king, of a leader, forgetting what he did, like we spoke before, but in a sense he would really building up this individual in the eyes of the people. He would himself be going against God, because they say what he did couldn't have been that bad. Something is beyond the doubt, giving him all the covenant. So what if he had a little idol here, a little idol there? So in a sense he would be going against, he would be doing a terrible injustice spiritually at this point too. So the idea of getting covered surely would not apply. Even the idea of a parent, we look to the people now, especially if the father goes ahead and he intentionally tells them, these are the boy, and they go ahead and they cremate it, right? So there's no thing that the child has to sit shiver, which is a thing of Avedos, which is because of the honor of the parents as a rush. We don't, normally we don't take honor of the parents as a rush, but I mean when it's something in the last moment done in such a blatant way, so then we say that the Dino Shiva and so on doesn't apply. There have been a few cases that this has come up, there are definitely correct. And now the second part of the phrase is Nishba Lehora, Oyomir. He takes a note, Lehora, to hurt, but not to hurt somebody else. But Lehora, like to hurt himself. Normally you're not supposed to use oaths. Oaths have to be guarded, because the word is sacred. The word is the instrument with which God created the world. The word is a heavenly form. In fact, the greatness of man, it says that man has the spirit of God, and the Targum interprets the spirit, meaning the Ruach Memalalo, a spirit that speaks. Speech. Words are a holy instrument. We can tell it's a holy instrument. You can't touch it, you can't feel it. It's not a physical thing. So therefore, an oath, which is specially taking God's name, or whatever it is, using it in a serious vein, is a very extreme case, and a person is not supposed to take an oath. The only time that you can take an oath, or that it's commendable, is in the case that we mentioned here. For instance, you have an example that a tzaddik pledges himself for abstinence, and he abstains. So then, but he realizes that he doesn't just want it to be a regular, what we call a New Year's resolution. You know, that he's not going to do this, not going to do that, he waits up January 2nd, he does everything that he's able to do January 1st. Because the person is very difficult himself. Yet we know that a lot of times a legal or halachic prohibition is enough to curtail. For example, there are people that they go nuts. Used to be they couldn't not to smoke. Used to be the worst kind of thing, right? Yet Shabbos they wouldn't smoke, although they would smoke four packs a day the rest of the week, but Friday, Shkia. So right after Abdullah, right? They have 8 o'clock before Shabbos was over, they're able to contain themselves not to smoke. Now it's almost impossible. Why? What a person can do it. What does it? The fact that Shabbos that does it. But for example, if you're dying away to eat some candy or ice cream, right? So the reward for that, the cure is, just take a little touch of meat and it'll be your desire. So the same idea here also, a person is not supposed to take an oath. Or the Talmud speaks of claim from the idea of a nausea, who is a Nazarite. And it says it's really not the Torah doesn't advocate it. Because they use the expression, like diet, prohibits, you don't have to go and look for further prohibitions. And therefore, the Gemara says that Shmuel HaKotan, this great person, said that once that he never ate from a sacrifice that a Nazir brought, because at the end of his Nazir, the end of his period, and the Nazirite had to make a sacrifice, he wouldn't find that. Why? Because he disapproved of the concept of Nazirus. It was not the best thing. You shouldn't have gone and accepted Mishnah vows upon yourself. Except one time, he says, I went ahead and And I did, because I saw a young man who was extremely handsome, he had beautiful locks of hair, and he was looking into a water in the pond, and he became enamored with his own appearance. And he said that in order that he shouldn't become too vain and be driven to sin, he accepts upon himself the vow of the Nazarite, to leave his hair and grow white. There's more like what he said, that this is the vow of the nausea which would be an acceptable, commendable practice, because it was the state guide here sin. So in a sense, the Rebbe HaMelech is saying, Nishba Ora, this righteous person knows that he has within him the Yetzer Hara, the inclination which will constantly gnaw at him in order to forsake it, you know, in order to transgress and give up what he's accepted. So it's in order to strengthen his resolve. So it's Nishba Ora. He accepts an oath that he will deprive himself of whatever he has. The Lo Yomir, he will not retract this oath. Now, the Talmud gives you another example as to an extreme. I gave you the type of taking a piece of meat, not beef, but there was Rav Yehuda, and one like I said, who was very humble, and he didn't want the honor of dining in the house of the Nasi. So what did he do? Whenever he would leave his home, he would take an oath not to eat any food until he comes back to his own house. So therefore, if he wasn't going to eat a meal any place, this vow gave him the strength, the fortitude, that he couldn't, no matter what the Nasi would try to get him to come to eat in his house, he would tell him that he can't. So Nishba L'Ara, lay on here. So that means that he used the oath in such a fashion. Now, a further attribute is Kaspari L'Nosam, that he doesn't lend money and interest. Now, not lending money and interest in our society, is really the attribute. Give actually money without it. But the commentator, Thomas Trouble, that's from Tamei Ashikea. Why do we have to thank him for not killing somebody? He didn't shed blood. And the Torah is very clear and direct that you're not allowed to lend money for interest. So just because he doesn't lend money for interest means you're extolling this virtue to what degree? It's not a virtue, it's just abiding by the obvious law of the Torah. So why do we extol this as a virtue? So they give you other examples that it's speaking. The literal one is, you know, you're not supposed to take interest from a Jew. From a non-Jew in the world of commerce, the way the world conducts itself, you're allowed to take interest. So this person will not even take interest from a person who doesn't violate the prohibition from a Gentile. Why? In order not to become accustomed to taking interest. Because if he takes interest, he can take interest from other people who there is a violation against taking interest. So that means he would lend money even to another person without interest when he was not required according to the law of the Torah. This is something that is difficult for us to appreciate. I mean, we can appreciate the general idea of not taking interest. But we know now that people take interest. Because unlawfully, there are mad ways which are permitted to do it. Why are you permitted to do it? There are two ways which are permitted. We call it heteriskin. Why did they make this heteriskin? What was the reason why the Torah forbid interest? That your brother should be able to live with you. The idea is that if the person needs money, loan him the money, like a free loan, not beat him up with interest. So therefore, of course, the interest would be exorbitant. It could be a loan shark, but it could also be very modest. Right, the money, half the money that you would get in the bank, I mean, it would be very modest. You're taking only a small amount. Like this, you could get 15%, you're giving it 5%. So what's the other? So the idea is that the Torah didn't want such a society. I mean, money wasn't given to you to accumulate other money, but it was given as a means of living your daily life. And if you have money, instead of putting it in the bank and accumulating it, you should help the next person. That's why your God entrusts you with money. I mean, this is if you're at a very high spiritual level, but what happens when the world doesn't think that way? So the poor person can't get a loan for 5%. Why? Because they're not allowed to take interest. So the whole purpose is really defeated. The whole idea was, we're not speaking about loan sharking, we're speaking about modest interest. The whole idea was, in order to give the poor person an opportunity to exist and to function, and if you can't take any interest at all, so what's going to happen? So it happened that as the time came, that nobody was able to borrow any money, and people were going around hungry because we're afraid to give them money. And therefore, you'd rather invest your money in a different way where you could get kosher results, interest. So they made what we call a heteriskin. where legally it's not a legal fiction. It's a legal way out. You could say, in a sense, it's not fulfilling the moral of the law. It is to a degree. But obviously you can't help it. Say, give you an example. Say if you're a person that's living on interest and you have a child or a friend of yours that wants to buy a home. This is something that happens 10 times a year. And you figure in advance they retire. And they have, say, $200,000 in the bank, so they have 10%, so they get $20,000. So they live on $20,000. A child wants to buy a home, and he makes a nice living, but he doesn't have a down payment. And if he goes to that bank, he couldn't get a mortgage, and if he did, he would have to pay 15-16%. So they are willing, if it's legally possible, to take out $100,000, to use the examples, and give it to the child for 10%. So at the same time, they would be able to live like they did with the money in the bank, and the child would be able to buy a home. What's wrong with that? But it's fetus, correct? So you have to have a way which we can understand there's nothing morally wrong. You'll say if the parent has millions of dollars and he doesn't need the money, so let him give the child the money without the 10%. But I'm giving you a common day to benefit both parties. The only one that would lose on it would be the bank. But it would benefit both parties, yet it's fetus. So then there are certain ways that it can be done. The very simple way in this case that I gave you a simple way, it's not a business view, it would be that you would, say, retain 50% ownership in the house. It would be considered like you bought as partners if the house is a $200,000 house. And then the son is living in your portion. So he would pay you rent for your portion of the house. So that's how it would work out in a sense. That you're a 50% owner of the house, $100,000, and for your $100,000 portion, he's using it. So he's paying you their $10,000 a year by rent, whatever it is. So legally, it's correct. And there's no sense the general principle that there is. It has different applications if you didn't do any business investments and so on. But if you had a person, we'll say, who wouldn't even do it, he'll lend you money and he refuses even to use it as a risk. Because of the moral aspect, the original thing of the Torah. So this is a tremendous virtue, right? The whole world can't conduct itself that way because, as I said, in some cases it would come out that both front sides would be losing. But the general principle, we don't look at it. Once we do that already, so we're in it for the interest. We're totally involved in the interest. You have to realize, even when certain things are permissible, but the concept is, like us and Vinesh, not to take interest in it. The Shochat al-Noki lo-Lokoch. Here it says also, he doesn't take a bribe against the innocent. Here, ask Kupta Mayashikeya. He doesn't take a bribe against the innocent. Here's a judge. And he has somebody in front of him. The person is innocent. He says, you want to go to jail for 20 years? No, you're innocent, right? I know you're innocent. He says, but it'll cost you $50,000. So I'm not going to answer that. I'll say, oh, you're innocent. You don't have to go to jail. So you can expel me. It's my virtue. Well, sometimes you could be living in a society, in this day of our society, where everything is what? With money. And if you have an honest inspector, an honest judge, you would have to extol his virtue. But that's not what Governor Mellon is speaking about. How is he speaking about it? So therefore, the Talmud tells us a situation. What the commentaries say, that it means, even if the fellow's innocent himself, you know he's innocent, you're going to pronounce him innocent, but you still won't take a gift. Right. It ameliorates the situation a little bit, but to me it doesn't seem that this is worthy of virtue. That means that you're going to your judge, and you just pronounced him innocent. So he's giving you a gift of $10,000. So that didn't influence your judgment, right? Yeah, you still refuse to take the gift. I think that's virtuous, but I would think that it's still not the... I would think that the person who has a strong moral sense would refuse to take that money anyway. But the Talmud gives us a further extreme. He had a sharecropper, and the sharecropper would bring a basket of fruits every Friday and his portion of the payment. Now, once the sharecropper brought the fruits on Thursday, Yishmael asked him, why did you alter this routine to the modern routine? So he says, well, Thursday is the day of courts, and I have to appear in court, so I'm going to appear in your court today. And I figured that since I'm coming into town anyway, why should I come again tomorrow Friday? I'll bring it already in on Thursday, and it'll save me a trip. So in the same sense, Yishmael refused, right? But Yishmael went ahead, and he refused to accept. Why? Because he felt that to be the judge, because this kindness that was done in bringing it a day early would have a certain influence on it. You'll say you're going to get it tomorrow anyway, but the truth of the matter is the smallest movement can even have an influence. I remember when I first came, I always use this as an example, because the person, I always see the person, he's still around, he had no bad intent. Now, when I first came to the city, quite a while ago, the young man, I was asked to participate in a mezzanine in that job, maybe 1 or 2 years, and then one of the people, two people came in, one I had known a little bit before, I had seen him a few times, so he walks in, smiles, and gives me a warm show of my life then. The other person never saw me before and walked in, but they had a blank stare because he didn't know. I felt when he gave me a warm smile, put out his hand, showing my light and myself a certain closeness in him. And I felt almost enough, I don't remember what they did, but I felt I could understand and appreciate how that could even be considered shit. The fact is because he really gave you a warm show of my light, and so I was going to refuse to respond to him. So it's not shaykhan actually means outright money or a big gift, but even a smile sometimes, one minute to a judge, can be considered already shaykhan, because it doesn't mean that that will influence the judge's decision, but the judge will have to have perhaps a little extra effort, a little extra push to come out with a decision which would be against this individual who recognized him and knows him and responds to him so nicely, gives him a warm shalom. So to go against it is going to take an extra ounce of effort. And therefore, that can be considered also a shokan. So this judge that we're speaking about here is the shokan al-noki. It's not even a question of exonerating the guilt. But even dealing with al-noki, with a case where it doesn't influence your judgment, but lo wakaki stays away from you. Ose eyeh, one who conducts himself according to these modes of conduct, will forever not falter. That means even if he collapses, Rashi says a little bit, he slips back, he's going to automatically rise again because of the tremendous reservoir of morality that this person happens to have within him, the reservoir of strength. Now he brings down the Gemara, brings down in the Medrash, just changes the name, a discussion that went on between two people, two Tanoim, Reb Gamliel, when he read this, would begin to cry. Because it says, Eisa Elam, Eilam, if you do all of these, Le'imet Le'elam, you won't slip. So who can flip by this? Who can always be careful and who can always, you can aspire to do it, but who can always fulfill all of these things? So it seems that if you neglect to do all of these modes, you're lacking in character, so you're lost. You might, you will fall away, you will falter. So Rabbi Akiva consoled him, and Rabbi Akiva said, it doesn't say, Asik kol eilet, le'imit le'elam. If you do all of these things, you won't sleep. It said, Asik eilet, le'imit le'elam. If you do these things, even if you do only one of these things, or you aspire to do these things, not that if you actually are able to fulfill all of that, but even if this is your goal in life, you're able to fulfill some of these, and you seek to fulfill them, so also, le'imit le'elam, you will not stumble, and you will be able to achieve greatness by rising again. So this is a very important chapter which David HaMelech presents. In a sense, what he's saying, he's presenting here the belief that man can actually be like an angel. Not like an angel, but close to an angel. That means it's a tremendous ladder to climb up, like Rabbi Shmuel himself would say. Rabbi Shmuel was crying. I mean, Rabbi Gamliel was crying and saying, how can a person aspire and achieve all of this? So we see how great, how difficult it is. Yet at the same time, we see that man has the opportunity, or man has the ability to ascend to such heights. He has the ability. For example, a student asked me the other day, he said, how could we 6,000 years has passed and we've never really reached these heights? In a sense, we failed twice, visibly, once by Ona Marishan, and the second time with the Aino. And now it's already, the end of 6,000 years, so maybe we can do it. But the fact that God made us in this sense shows us that we can. I told him, really, the fact that Ona Marishan, we can appreciate that Ona Marishan could have gone another few hours without succumbing to the temptation. And the eagle, they surely didn't have to, because of the meaning, didn't worship the eagle, they may not have tainted it. So we see that people do have the ability within them. But it's a life of work. Understand? Instead of making your life's vocation to become a tremendous few hours a week to work for him, to just have food to fuel to exist on. But this is your vocation in life, then you can tell me that it's almost impossible. We agree that it's impossible if our whole effort is limited to a few periods a week. Just like it would be impossible to be an excellent doctor or a lawyer or any professional if you only put in a few hours a week. But on the other hand, if you go ahead and you consider this to be the purpose why you're here, and this is your vocation in life, so it's definitely possible you have the ability to do this. If you can ascend to the moon in the spaceship, you can also go ahead and ascend to the moon spiritually, if you put all your effort into that research. Right? There's nothing out of the theater, President. We can put we can build a space place in the sky, right? So we can also build a spiritual castle in the sky. I mean, there's nothing beyond man's ability. As long as man can envision what he's looking for, if he has the ability, the only thing that we don't know is what is before B.S.A.L. Everything which is after B.S.A.L., if we can just envision what it is, we have the ability to accomplish it in a spiritual